Breaking Unbelief, the podcast that challenges your mind. Welcome to the Breaking Unbelief podcast. This is Nick Daniels.
And I'm Tim Chafee. We've done episodes in the past concerning the age of the earth and what the Bible has to say about it. We've talked about the days of creation, the extent of the flood, the problem of distant starlight, and many other related issues. Nick, as you know, one of the biggest objections that people have to biblical creationism is that radiometric dating has allegedly proven that the earth is much older than what the Bible states.
That's right, and today we have a very special guest who is going to help us answer that objection. Dr. DeYoung is chairman of physical science at Grace College, Indiana, and he holds a PhD in physics from Iowa State University. He has published technical papers in the Journal of Chemical Physics and the Creation Research Society Quarterly. And Dr. DeYoung is the author of several books on Bible science topics, including the book we are going to talk about today, entitled Thousands, Not Billions. Dr. DeYoung, welcome to the Breaking Unbelief podcast.
Yes, glad to join you.
Dr. DeYoung, you did not start out as a biblical creationist. You actually believe that the Earth and universe are billions of years old. What led you to change your mind in this area?
My training was in engineering, and all the books and the professors talk about billions of years and an animal ancestry that we have and that dinosaurs lived long before time. That's all I heard. I did become a believer, a Christian, and really struggled to put it together, especially the book of Genesis and the book of Revelation, for that matter. And I kind of had that duality, just didn't know quite what to think. Creation kind of came across as something that was outdated and from the past. Well, when I hit grad school, one weekend, a speaker came to town, to our campus. This was Iowa State, Ames, Iowa. And this speaker challenged us to consider the idea of a recent supernatural creation. I just hadn't heard that before. I didn't know you could do that anymore. And I listened with great interest, and it made a lot of sense to me, because I always realized that the ages they came up with for the Earth, whether it's geology or astronomy or whatever, are rather subjective and rather artificial. So anyway, a speaker challenged me long ago, and I've been studying that with great interest ever since, and more firmly believe that science has gone off on a tangent with its long ages and really is an error and has impoverished itself as a result. The young Earth view, both from biblical study and from the study of nature, makes good sense.
You were one of the members of the RATE group. Can you tell us about the RATE group? What were your goals? Who else was a part of this group? And why is this group so important for us to understand and the work that they did? Why is it so important in this ongoing debate over the age of the Earth?
Well, about 10 years ago, several of us that are involved in full-time science careers of teaching and research, we thought it might be a good time to reevaluate this whole area of radioisotope dating. It's been around about 100 years, and it's just widely accepted and assumed to be, you know, the absolute truth, and we had our doubts. Now, we're a group of Christian men and are not against science or inquiry or experiments, but just had some suspicions about the whole age of the Earth issue. And so we got together and came up with this acronym RATE, Radioisotopes and the Age of the Earth, and thus began a research program, again, to take a look and find some samples for ourselves and get them dated by state-of-the-art laboratories, just to see what we might find. The experiment went on for several years. It involved traveling around the world to collect samples and getting in contact with technicians in, again, labs such as Carbon-14 labs. And it was quite interesting, and we weren't exactly sure what we were going to find out, whether we might just kind of turn away. But the closer we looked, the more we saw that there is strong evidence for a recent supernatural creation. And so that was the work of the RATE group. Actually, it still goes on. The way this business operates in science, every time you get an answer, it seems like two more questions pop up. But that's the excitement of it all. And so actually, the RATE project continues.
Your book, Thousands Not Billions, is essentially the layman's level book, which provides the results of the Rate Group's research. Let's take a little time going through some of the research you have written about. One of the greatest obstacles facing biblical creationists is radioisotope dating. We are often told that several varieties of this type of dating prove the Earth is much older than the Bible teaches. Can you briefly explain to our listeners how these type of dating methods are supposed to work, and what are some of the assumptions that scientists make when conducting these types of tests?
Laboratory work. When we are measuring these radioactive isotopes, we're into the parts per trillion or even less. It's very exotic, high class chemistry that's done. But the fact is, we are cranking out numbers from our machines, and these numbers are always open to interpretation. And that's what our rate group was choosing to do, to give an alternative interpretation of the whole story. This method, radioisotope dating, again, has been around about a century. Carbon-14 is more recent, about maybe 50 years old. The way this operates, certain elements in the Earth are radioactive. There's different kinds of carbon. Some kinds are stable, other kinds are radioactive. And you can find these temporary radioactive elements in rocks, different places. They're like an alarm clock. They're winding down. And sooner or later, these radioactive elements, they turn into something else. They're not carbon-14 anymore. They turn into nitrogen-14. It's not that they disappear, but they just transmute into a different kind of element. And there are about a half a dozen of them that are of special use that are often found in rocks, things like uranium or potassium or rubidium. And these occur in few parts in different kinds of rocks. And the thought is that when a new rock forms, let's say it's igneous rock, that it forms from a melt, that there may or may not be daughter atoms in it to begin with. It's the parent atoms that turn into daughter atoms. But anyway, if you have a rock that's formed from a melt and it's cooled off and it's a part of a Grand Canyon formation or whatever, you take this rock sample and you analyze it. You see how much parent atom is left in it and how much has converted into a daughter element. Again, you have to take account of maybe some initial daughter amount that was in the rock. You have to take account of any kind of contamination. Atoms are on the move in this world. They can migrate into a sample or out of a sample. There are ways to try to take account of these various changes that can occur. Some of them we're familiar with and some that we aren't. But that's how the method works. You end up measuring perhaps a ratio of how many parent atoms to how many daughters, and there's other kinds of correlations you can make. And then you can estimate the age of the rock. The interesting thing is, some of these radioactive elements, the isotopes, as we call them, that are radioactive, they have long half-lives. They're very stable, and they slowly cook away. I mean, these half-lives can be on the order of millions or billions of years. And those half-lives are actually accurate. We can measure that in the laboratory in one afternoon. But again, when you get them in a rock, then over time it's thought that they cook away. And so again, that's what we're measuring, the amounts of atoms that are in rocks, minerals, fossils. It's the only method that geologists have when it comes to long ages, at least the only absolute method to come up with a date. And we believe that because of that, the whole method is trusted in too highly, and some of the possible changes that can occur are overlooked. And again, that gave rise to our fresh look at this from a creationist viewpoint.
I know the Rate Group made some very interesting discoveries regarding carbon-14. Can you tell us about the results you obtained from dating coal from several different coal seams?
Certainly can. Carbon-14, I don't know, maybe that strikes fear into some people because it sounds evolutionary and long age. But we were on a mission, so we decided to explore carbon-14. Now, of the different radioactive isotopes that are typically used in dating, carbon-14 is pretty short. It's only 5,730 years for its half-life. It's thought that it doesn't even apply to things like rocks or coal. It's more used by archaeologists for just, let's say, a few millennia. Well, we decided to explore it from a fresh viewpoint, carbon 14. So we obtained some coal samples. Now, these are from coal fields all around North America. And coal, you know, is said to come from the Carboniferous age, somewhere between 30 million and maybe 300 million years old. And secular science would say carbon 14 can no longer exist in coal. Even if it had some to start with, it's got to be long cooked away, changed into something else. It shouldn't be there. We obtained a dozen samples, and we did not have to go down into coal mines. Actually, they were provided by the U.S. government. They have a coal bank where they keep samples, and you can get them for research, and we applied and received these samples. Now, we could have set up our own laboratory to measure for carbon-14, but probably we would not be trusted or respected as creationists. So we took these samples and approached top laboratories around the world. There's a few of them where they make these carbon-14 measurements. I still remember what happened when we would talk to these technicians. They would say, "What do you want us to do? Measure for carbon-14 in coal? You'll be wasting your time and money. There can't be any. We haven't done this before." But we had some resources to carry this out, and so we hired them to do this. The results came back. And every sample of coal that we have looked at, we do find carbon-14, to the great surprise of these technicians. And from that, with some assumptions, you can start to put some ages on that coal, and it's not hundreds of millions of years old. Instead, the technicians, the best they could say is that it looked like this coal might be 50,000 years old or less. Further data reduction by ourselves, we feel strongly that that number is much less, perhaps as young as 4,500 years old for the coal all across North America. 4,500 years. That puts us back to about 2,500 B.C., We believe that's approximately the time of Noah and the Genesis flood. Our conclusion, it may be that the great coal reserves that we find across America and across the whole world, for that matter, are a reservoir of great forests, trees, canopies that were rapidly buried and then coalified during the Genesis flood.
The Wright Group also conducted C14 dating on diamonds. Why was it so important and what were the results?
Well, after we had our interesting results for coal, we thought, let's push this step even further. Let's take a look at something that is said to be some of the oldest on the planet. It's made out of carbon, but again said to be carbon-14 dead. And so our thought turned to diamonds. They're made out of pure carbon. They're thought to come from deep in the earth, a billion years old or more, typically said. Well, we obtained diamond samples, most of them from South Africa, of course. And now we have our samples, and back to the laboratory we go to talk to the technician, and he says, "What are you doing this time?" And we told him we wanted him to analyze diamonds for carbon-14, and he laughed and said, "It's impossible. I've never done that before. You can't possibly get an answer." But we did hire him to carry this out. I might add that at this stage, something unfortunate happens. To analyze diamonds for carbon-14, you need to take the diamond sample and grind it into a powder. And in their spectrometers, they take that powder and they turn it into a gas. They need to do this to analyze for carbon-14. The diamonds are gone. You don't get them back. It's a destructive experiment. But we carry this out, and of the dozen diamonds we looked at, as for coal, we have found remaining carbon-14 in every diamond sample that we look at. This is to a great surprise to the technician and to the geologist that we've talked to. We ourselves have a little trouble explaining how that carbon-14 got in there. Our best response is that this is from the creation, that these diamonds are not all that old. Maybe they did come from deep in the earth, but the creator put carbon-14 in them at the start, and it's not all cooked away yet. The diamonds dated actually a little bit older than the coal. I don't think the diamonds originate from the flood. They probably go back to the creation week. It turns out that everything we're looking at, coal, diamonds, rocks, minerals, fossils, it all has carbon-14 in it. which is a suggestion that all of these things are only thousands of years old.
All right. Since there are so many varieties of radioisotope dating, the Rate Group decided to send several different samples to a few geochronology labs for dating. If the popular scientific view is correct, then we should expect to find close agreement on the dating of each of these samples from several dating methods. What did you find?
Well, we found some interesting results when we compared these different methods, and it's called discordance, that very often they were not in agreement. One of our research areas that comes to mind, there's a volcanic mountain down in New Zealand, Narahowie it's called. And this mountain every so often erupts. In fact, it did 50 years ago. And the lava cooled, turned into basalt, and you can go down there and walk on it, and it's only 50 years old. By permission, it's in a park down there. We got some of the basalt samples, and we decided we would get these things radioisotope dated by several different methods because they have a variety of these isotopes within the basalt. And again, rather than set up our own laboratory, we hired this out to state-of-the-art labs, and the results were interesting. We did it with the isotope potassium that turns into argon. There they got a short age, kind of as we expected. They said it looked like this sample is quite young. We took seven of the basalt samples and sent them to a lab that does rubidium-strontium dating. And the result came back, the printout from all their instruments and computers, and it said it looks like this basalt is 133 million years old. We hadn't told them where we got it from, but we talked to the technician later and said, you're not quite right. It's not 133 million. It's 50 years old. We went to another laboratory where they analyzed some samarium, which turns into neodymium. This is another area of use in geology. And the result came back from the same samples that these rocks appear to be about 197 million years old. Finally, we went to a laboratory that does lead-lead dating. This is very popular in geology today. And several samples again, and actually several laboratories. And the answer came back that they thought that these samples that we had were 3 billion 900 million years old. We know that they're only 50 years old. People are around that watched those rocks form. The conclusion here is that when you do know how old a rock is, the methods don't seem to work well at all. So how can we have any confidence in chipping out some rock that we don't know about and in believing the answer that comes out from these experiments? Again, I don't mean to denigrate the chemistry. It's very fancy stuff they do, but they're cranking out numbers. And instead of the age of these rocks, I think what they're telling us is contamination, original material that was in the rock, changing half-life or whatever, instead of the age, it's more complicated than they are assuming.
Dr. DeYoung, one of your chapters in your book is entitled Helium Retention in Zircon Crystals. Why is it important for our listeners to know that there is still a great deal of helium in zircon crystals?
Well, the helium in granite was a work mainly done by Russ Humphreys, and that was quite interesting. For this experiment, we got some samples, granite, that had formed deep in the earth. I mean, more than a mile down. These were deep drilling projects, and we obtained these samples. When uranium decays, it makes helium atoms. Or we could just call it alpha particles, but it's helium. And, of course, that's a light element. They put that in balloons. It kind of carries them up in the air. And so way down deep in the earth, we have this uranium decaying, and it's making multiple helium atoms inside the crystals inside granite. Well, if these rocks are anywhere near as old as they say, the helium should long ago have leaked out of those rocks, kind of migrated up to the surface of the earth. You just can't stop helium. It moves around. And even if you have a helium balloon, sooner or later it falls to the floor. The helium moves right through the membrane of the balloon, and it moves through the crust of the earth as well. And so we do have some helium in the atmosphere, and they say maybe that comes from rock decay. But again, we have these samples from way down deep, and they're said to be very old, multi-millions of years old. And we measured those for helium that might still be remaining in them. And we find lots of helium, as if there has not been time for the helium to move out of those rocks, as we know that it does. We did some experiments to measure the diffusion of helium through modern rocks in the laboratory. We know what those little atoms do. There's too much helium underground. If we had the multi-millions of years, that helium should be long gone and up in the sky. It's kind of similar to the carbon-14. We're finding things that aren't expected to be present, but they are, and we see these as possible young Earth indicators.
Perhaps the most controversial area of research had to do with accelerated nuclear decay. Many people who believe in the billions of years are quick to dismiss the Rate Group's findings in this area because of the dangers associated with accelerated decay. What evidence is there for accelerated nuclear decay, and can you tell us about some of the difficulties with it?
Accelerated decay is a controversial issue, and those of us on the Rate Group, we weren't divided, but we're not, frankly, very comfortable with the idea, but we were led that way. Half-life, the lifetime of these radioactive materials, seems to be very stable today. In fact, sometimes in the lab we try to change half-lives. You can take a radioactive material, you can heat it up, you can do chemistry on it, you can put huge pressure on it. We can't seem to do much to the half-life at all. It's well shielded or sheltered within the nucleus. It's pretty much permanent today. But again, our suggestion is that half-lives and radioactive decay may have been greatly accelerated at perhaps more than one point in history. Now, there were several lines of evidence that lead to that. Let me just mention one. In the Grand Canyon, we have these multiple layers, the sandstone, the limestone, the shale, alternating. And between some of those layers, we have where lava flowed, shot up from deep in the earth, and got caught in those layers and then hardened. And we like that igneous kind of rock because that's the kind of thing that you can get some granite out of and analyze it for ages and isotopes and things like that. And so in the Grand Canyon, we found some of these volcanic materials that are interspersed with sedimentary rock. Now, in our creationist viewpoint, we believe that all of these sedimentary layers form in 1 year. This is all flood rock. And likewise, this molten material has come up. It was a very turbulent time, tectonics during the flood, and that also got placed in between these rock layers and then cooled. There was so much going on. So we have this this granite that we say also formed in one year's time. Well, when we look at these pieces of granite, we find that there's evidence of lots of decay that's occurred. There's a lot of daughter products where the uranium has changed. There are a lot of things called fission tracks where the products of decay have become permanent in the rock. There surely has been an immense amount of radioactive decay that occurred in this rock that we feel formed in 1 year's time. And by the way, there's other evidences that it didn't happen a long time after that, but all during that 1 year period. In fact, when you take these things that I mentioned, like fission tracks, if you take a piece of granite and then just heat that up to, let's say, a couple of hundred degrees centigrade, it'll wash away the fission tracks. They'll go away. But we still have them in the rock, which shows us that once it cooled, that those granites have never been warmed up again. And any time you have a rock that you would say is a million or a billion years old, there's been all sorts of opportunities for heat and stress. The fact that we still see these fission tracks and other things are indications that the rock is not all that old. Anyway, because of all of these products that we find of decay, and also our position that the canyon and the rocks formed in 1 year, we conclude that this is evidence that the decay happened rapidly during the flood. Some of the other granite samples we look at are not flood rocks. They're way down at the bottom of the crust. They look like their original creation rock. So we furthermore suggest that some of this accelerated decay might have occurred during the creation week itself. It's pretty lofty to talk about a pick up an acceleration of radioactive decay when we can't do it today. But that's our position, and we're still trying to gather further evidence for that. Our position is that during the flood, everything was just very much out of control. More precipitation than ever before, more erosion, more rock formation, and now even more radioactive decay than ever before.
Now, one of the criticisms of biblical creationism is that scientists like yourself do not publish in peer-reviewed scientific journals. How do you respond to that type of criticism, and has any of the right research been submitted to scientific journals?
Well, that's a good question, whether we are kind of shying away from secular literature or not. All I can tell you is that our track record, the scientists I know, and I might mention one group called the Creation Research Society, 1,700 practicing scientists all around the world, guys and gals, we do research and we carry in what we can. When we have some writing that we would like to submit to one of the secular journals, it gets thrown back at us. The establishment view today is an old earth, and science does not allow, you know, a foot in the door when it comes to a creation beginning. And so the papers that we write are dismissed by the secular world. We've tried. We're just rejected. I'm sure that some of our listeners have seen the movie Expelled, and it shows it's even worse than being rejected. You'll be fired if you're a professor and you admit to giving time to the creation viewpoint. Mm-hmm. As a result, the best that we can do is start our own journals and our own websites and online publications, and we do that. And it's difficult maybe to get the other side to read them. The group I mentioned a moment ago, the Creation Research Society, we produce a quarterly. In fact, it goes back 50 years now. And we offer those to university libraries. Some of them accept a free subscription and some don't. So we're trying to get our research out as best we can. Now, in the geology world, one area of success we have had with the RATE project is to have some exposure of our ideas. Very often at their conferences, they have what's called a poster session. It's not a main talk, but in the hallways, by permission, you can put up posters of your findings. And this is great for conversation and people walking by, and many geologists do this. And we've been welcomed to do that. And we've carried that out with our RATE research, and it leads to a lot of results. And I must tell you, geologists are very interested when we tell them about carbon-14 in coal or diamonds, the kind of thing that they've never even entered their mind before. So we're doing as best we can. I don't really see any change there in getting our material into the secular literature. It's really the main science in our country is controlled by the National Academy of Science. In fact, they're the ones that counsel the government. And that's a group of hundreds of guys and gals who've all been brought up with the evolutionary worldview. That's all they know, and that seems to be all they'll tolerate. But at the same time, the creation movement is making good progress. People are hearing about this because they realize it's exciting. It's kind of fun to be the underdog, but I think we're on the right side, and we're getting the word out as best we can.
Dr. DeYoung, you also have a brand new book entitled Discovery of Design. Please tell us a little bit about this book.
Well, thank you. This is a new book published by Master Books, Discovery of Design. What we have come to realize, our position, is that this world is filled with hundreds of practical, useful ideas placed there by the Creator for us to find, to discover, and then to put to use and come up with useful applications. It's sort of in the direction of intelligent design, the planning that we see in the earth. This is where inventors and engineers are looking these days for new ideas, how to solve problems. They're looking at nature. We took 100 of these ideas and have written them up in this book, Discovery of Design, and there are many more ideas besides. The example that our listeners would be familiar with would be something like Velcro. that fastener that's everywhere. That idea came from a cockle burr that was stuck to clothing of a person, you know, walking through the woods long ago. He got home and looked closely at this little burr and saw the little hooks on it and thought he could make some artificially, and that's modern Velcro made out of nylon. Many ideas like this, and they're kind of fun to look at. And the book Discovery of Design, we have a picture of the object in nature, and then the product or the what we've made from that. And this is a new book that's out. We've also started a website, discoveryofdesign.com, where we're collecting these ideas. Usually, it's said that these things like Velcro or the tail of a peacock have formed very slowly over time, mutations and natural selection. Well, we're taking the other side. In fact, we see these wonderful designs as far back as you look. Even ideas are coming from the fossil record, from the very creation week. We've had these countless ideas that God gave us, and I'm sure that most of these useful ideas in nature are yet to be discovered. They're still out there.
Where can our listeners find out more about your books and other resources?
Well, I appreciate that question. If they would go to our website, I say our because a co-author and I have written the book Discovery of Design, but if you would go to Discovery of Design, that's just all one word, .com, you could click on books and you'd find the books that I've written. I like to write in the area of Bible and science. I write books that have sort of a question-answer approach, and I have books on questions about astronomy, the weather, the dinosaurs. There's also some books they would find on that website that are activities and lessons for kids. I like to do experiments, hands-on things for kids of all ages, and so those books are available, discoveryofdesign.com.
Dr. DeYoung, thank you so much for joining us on the Breaking Unbelief podcast.
Thanks for letting me share.
Well, Tim, the fact that all these laboratories got different results from samples whose dates were known is very telling, I think. What we can see here is that all these dating methods are actually self-fulfilling regarding the predictions of old Earth geology and evolution, but really do not tell us the true history of the world like the Bible does.
Well, that's exactly right. And Nick, one of the things I really appreciated about the interview is that Dr. DeYoung is able to take these highly advanced scientific processes and these ideas and explain them in a way that the average person can understand. And I think he did a good job of that in this interview. And he's also done a great job of that in the book, Thousands, Not Billions. And for those of our listeners who are interested in this book, they might want to know that there's also a DVD that goes with this book that has some great animations that help illustrate how these processes work. So I would highly encourage our listeners to pick up both of those products.
Well, and check out breakingandbelief.org for more episodes of our podcast, and thanks for tuning in. Talk to you soon.